You're listening to the RightStream Radio Network, rejoicing in the flow of creativity. Be sure to follow us on Twitter at RightStream and hashtag RightStream. Thanks for listening to the RightStream Radio Network.
Welcome to the Speculative Fiction Cantina with your host, S. Evan Townsend.
And hello, everybody. This is the Speculative Fiction Cantina, your weekly hypodermic injection of science fiction, fantasy, horror, alternate history, and all things weird and wonderful in the world of books and writers. I am your host, S. Evan Townsend. I have 5 published science fiction and fantasy novels. If you'd like to learn more about me, go to my website, that's www.sevantownsend.com, that's sevantownsend.com, all one word. And this show isn't about me, though. It's about other writers. And today on the Speculative Fiction Cantina, we are very pleased to welcome 2 writers, Voss Foster and Justin Oldman. Now, if you'd like to speak with either of our guests or ask a question or have a comment, call 347-945-7246. And press 1 to be put in the queue for going on the air. That lets me know you want to be on the air. And if you'd like more information about these writers, links to their novels, links to their websites, go to my blog at blog.sevantownsend.com. Justin and Voss, welcome. Thank you for being on the show today.
Somebody glad to something. Be here, Evan.
Thank you, Justin. Hello, Voss.
Hello.
How is everybody today?
Doing cold. Very well here in warm, sunny Anchorage, Alaska.
Did you say cold, Voss?
Yeah, it's kind of cold outside here.
Yeah, okay. So, Justin, I was reading about you, and you said you're legally blind. You're born legally blind, is that correct?
Yes, indeed. Came out of the womb that way.
Okay. What challenges does that present you in your writing?
Well, it's more technological than anything else. Trying to use a computer that I can't see is a bit of a challenge, and trying to write about things that actually I have never seen before is also something of a challenge because my distance vision doesn't actually go any more than 30 to 40 feet. And I'm a big fan of aviation. My father was a helicopter pilot who did 3 tours in Vietnam. I've been around aviation for most of my life. So I have to get up close and personal to just about everything. So the airplanes and helicopters I am familiar with, I've actually had to physically touch them. So beyond that, everything that I do is pretty much theater of the mind.
Wow, interesting. I read somewhere, maybe Voss, you can confirm this, that Huxley, who wrote the Brave New World, was also blind. I don't know if that's true. I should have researched that before the show. Voss, how are you doing today? You said you're cold. You write fantasies. Go ahead. Fantasy, science fiction, paranormal, horror. Do you find it difficult to switch between the genres?
No, each project is pretty separate in my head and in my notes, so it's easy for me to compartmentalize everything and not mix things up.
But each genre, you sort of have to have a different voice and a different way of presenting information, and you're able to keep that all straight?
Yeah, for the most part. I mean, some of it comes in editing, but for the most part, when I write it, it's fairly clean.
Editing, a writer's best friend. Justin, I was reading, you have a vision for the future involving Alaska and the Kodiak Space Launch Complex, which is a real place. Can you tell us more about your vision for Alaska and space?
Certainly. Well, I am the author of Tales from the Kodiak Starport, and this whole thing got started back in the summer of 1997 when Governor Tony Knowles announced a partnership between the state of Alaska and the Alaska Aerospace Development Corporation, which is a private sector organization. So this is a quasi private public operation. You can actually look them up on the internet. It is the Alaska Aerospace Development Corporation, AADC, and the Kodiak Space Launch Complex is a real place today. But once upon a time, when I first heard about this, I was listening to Governor Knowles give his press conference live, and the very first thing I thought about was Kodiak Starport. It was just suddenly right there, because what is a space launch complex going to be when it grows up but a starport? So my imagination immediately went to work, but life and professional commitments got in the way, and I wasn't able to get to it for about 15 years, and so here we are today.
That's interesting you talk about launch complexes growing up, because it reminded me of Chicago's O'Hare Airport. You know, the three-letter designation is ORD, and doesn't make any sense because O'Hare, well, it used to be an orchard, and it was Orchard Airport when it first started, and that's why it's ORD. They're actually talking about launching into space from Kodiak Island in Alaska?
Yes. Now, the interesting thing here is that the notion of a commercial starport is not unique to Alaska. Actually, down in New Mexico, specifically in the Mojave Desert, Virgin Galactic is building a facility that they're calling the New Mexico Starport. And unfortunately, you may have heard about the crash of Spaceship Two, which recently made it into the news. And you know, this is tough stuff. Space flight is still dangerous, but we are beginning to see the early concept of commercial space travel take hold as NASA is stepping away from its role as the gatekeeper of space flight, and now we're seeing companies like SpaceX that are stepping up to take the lead in the private sector. So I'm really quite optimistic about the future. And as I look at what's going on with the Alaskan economy, from the days of the Trans-Alaska Pipeline to the present, we have, to a certain extent, been bootstrapping our way up the industrial food chain. So now, today, as we prepare to build an in-state gas line, with things like the Kodiak Space Launch Complex, it's not hard to imagine by mid-century, 2050 or so, that we could start to see things like private sector commercial space launches from things like Virgin Galactic, and I don't know if it'll be Alaska-based space tourism or not, but hopefully I get to live long enough to see it.
Yeah, we all would like to see that. Voss, tell us about your book, and I might mispronounce this, tell me how to pronounce your book and tell me about it.
It's Tartarus. And
Tartarus, sorry.
And it's the basically the fall of a demon hunter as he, for his love, who happens to be the queen of hell, and he falls from being, you know, a killer of demons and a master of the hunt into ruling by her side as a demon, and then eventually destroying the world.
Well, that's a happy ending. Destroying
world? Yeah, Earth.
Okay. Earth, okay. That's, like I said, I get sometimes accused of writing sad endings, but I've never destroyed the Earth. Not yet, at least. What made you decide to write a story where the Earth blows up in the end or is destroyed?
By the time I got there, it made sense. I've always loved tragic endings and tragic stories, and especially tragic love stories. And so to have this couple end up, you know, destroying Earth and freeing the spirit so she can finally be dressed. It worked for me.
Yeah. Very interesting. You have a series, I think it's a series. It's a Zecura Fantastic and the Jester Prince. Mm-hmm. Are those part of a series?
Yes, those are the first two books of the King Jester trilogy.
And they're about a circus, from what I've read?
Yeah, it starts out as a circus.
Tell us more about that. How did you decide to write a novel series that starts out with a circus?
I was actually driving down the road one day, and I had my laptop on for music because my radio is completely useless in my car. And this song came on. Instead of talking about the carnival leaving town and tearing down the circus and all of that, and it just struck me that, oh, well, that might actually be interesting. And then the ideas started flowing, and by the time I got home about an hour later, I'd started to form this magical circus and all these gods and immortals roaming around the United States for hundreds of years.
Interesting. And you're planning on three books, and I believe the Jester Prince just came out not that long ago.
Yes, it was August, I think.
August, okay. That's interesting. You said it starts out as a circus. How does it evolve?
Well, the circus was there to hold down, to bind the spirit of Discord, who had tried to wage war about 200 years ago and destroy Earth. It's a common theme in my work. And so they created the circus as part of a magical contract to bind him, and it breaks, which means the circus is no more. But the characters from the circus still band together because it's sacred ground to be at that last lot where they performed.
It sounds very detailed and layered. You put a lot of thought into it, your backgrounds and your backstory of your characters and your setting. Is that correct?
Yeah, for the most part. Some of it just came spur of the moment, but then I worked back from there.
Yeah, that's sort of how I write, is just spur of the moment. Justin, you've already talked about Tales from the Kodiak Starport a little bit. This is a series of short stories, it looks like. Tell us more about it.
My long-term goal is continue writing in this particular universe. But before I did that, I wanted to set the benchmark or take a series of snapshots of what I thought it would look like over what amounted to a 200-year arc. So I wrote a series of 8 short stories all told that in my own mind chronologically take place over 200 years and involve a wide variety of different character types. And the goal was to showcase that you could use the setting to tell different stories that essentially take place in different genres. You can use any setting to tell any number of stories, pick a town, pick a country, a planet, whatever you want, and just run with it. So that's what I've decided to do here. And beginning next year, 2015, we'll actually start releasing a bunch of different standalone novels. I have 2 of them in the can right now and a 3rd under development, and each one will be genre specific, but they'll all be tied to the location of the fictional Kodiak Starport. And all of it is speculative about the nature of starports and what they will be in the future, and you know the impacts that they're going to have on society, government, economics, etc.
Sounds very interesting. Voss, Justin is as you heard, is legally blind. I'm dyslexic, makes me a horrible speller. Thank God for spell check, and makes me a horrible proofreader. Do you have any challenges you face when you're writing?
Well, I'm actually on the autism spectrum, so but it doesn't necessarily affect it in any way I've noticed, but I've lived with it for quite a while, obviously, so I could be okay. Just biased.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, when you live with things, you pretty much just, you think that's the way they are when you're a kid. Everybody's this way, right? I was blind as a bat when I was a kid, and I thought everybody else was blind as a bat, and I was amazed when people could see things that I couldn't see. And finally they got me glasses when I was 6 years old, and it's like, it was a whole new world. And so, Justin, your other book, and again, I might pronounce this wrong, Bibix, is it also set in Alaska?
Yes, indeed it is. You got to write what you know, and I like living here very much. Alaska has given me challenges and opportunities that I haven't found anywhere else. All told, I've been to 29 of the 50 states, and this is the one I happen to like the most, so it seemed appropriate for me to set that book in this location, and Bibix is my first stab at what you could think of as alien psychology, because the hero is named Bibix, and he's an alien, he's an extraterrestrial, and nobody is ever going to accuse me of being a pacifist. I am at times perhaps a little too aggressive for my own good, and that stems from the fact that I have had to be my own advocate ever since I could walk and talk, and being a person with a disability from day one, I've always had to explain myself to somebody, and most of the time when I apply for a job, the answer is no. And when you wear glasses as big as Coke bottles, most of the time, the job interview ends as soon as you walk into the room. So you have got to develop a thick hide in order to deal with that. So I decided to challenge myself by writing a character who was the exact opposite. So I asked myself, okay, how does a pacifist, a dyed-in-the-wool pacifist, go from that to being the most ardent defender of his people? And that's what you have in the story of Bibix. And it was quite difficult because it's not just enough to say, well, he got really mad and he decided to fight back, because that's the common reaction for people with disabilities. You reach a point in your life, and for a lot of us, it's our teens and it's our 20s, and yeah, maybe something somewhere in the old gray matter snaps, and you've just had enough. And you either become a bully or you become an advocate, and you're on your way, and you do what it is you do. But I decided to force myself to a more deep and meaningful writer's challenge. And it took about a year of reading psychology and talking to some of my more pacifist-oriented friends and beating my head against the wall when nobody was looking, because it was very difficult for me to understand pacifism. But eventually, when I kind of sort of had a handle on it, I got started, and the project was, all told, 2 years in development, and it is what you see today.
That's very interesting. What do you have planned for the future? You say you have two more books coming out, you have two books ready for the Kodiak Starport. How many books are you planning? What's in the future for you?
I am working on a total of 3 Kodiak Starport novels. And that's just what's in the immediate future. At least 2 of those will come out in calendar year 2015. That's as far as I can plan for at the moment. And for the time being, that I think is enough. I mean, it's 12 months out, and for the life of a writer, that's a good long time.
Yeah, I don't plan beyond tomorrow, so I think I'll get up tomorrow morning and and show up for what I have to do. Voss, what's in the future for you? What are you working on?
Well, right now I'm working on a sequel to a sci-fi series that's hopefully going to come out. And later in the year, I plan to start a web serial, which is another sci-fi. And hopefully next year, the last King Jester book will be coming out, barring the unforeseen.
I'm sorry, what was that last part?
Hopefully the last King Jester book will come out next year, barring the unforeseen.
Oh, barring the unforeseen. That was. Do you have a title for that yet?
Yes, it's A Fool's War.
Fool's War. Sounds very interesting. So, Voss, I want to ask you, why did you start writing? What got you on the writing bug?
You know, I honestly don't know. I've been writing since first grade. I have the really terrible short stories to prove it that my parents kept for some reason. But I don't know, around middle school I started writing terrible poetry too. And then high school hit and I stopped for about 2 years. And then right after high school I turned out a book. So.
Wow. Impressive. So yeah, you're not real old, are you?
No, 23.
23, wow. At 23, I would have given my right arm to have a published novel. I didn't have my first published novel until I was 52. Anyway. Yeah, and I'm sort of like you. I started writing when I was 12, not first grade, but 12, so that's what, sixth grade? And I hope my parents didn't keep me in that stuff, because I'm sure it was pretty awful. So. Justin,
I've got one thing in common with Voss. I started committing this crime at an early age, but thankfully, the acid in paper has gotten rid of a great deal of the evidence. I have in my possession most of what remains, and I'm coming up on the half century mark. And if what I have in my possession is any indication, the evidence is not going to outlive me, thankfully. So the early work will not survive me to be exploited at a later date. But I've always known I was going to be a writer, and I never questioned it.
Wow, that's really good. You should have put that stuff on archive grade acid free paper, and then you wouldn't have this problem with it.
No, I shouldn't have.
Justin, what do you love about writing?
What do I not like about it? It's I couldn't not do this. I don't know if that makes me OCD or what. It's just nobody told me to do it. It's just something that I have in my blood. And if my parents had not encouraged me to it, I probably still would have done it anyway. But from early days, I was encouraged. And the thing that was probably the biggest help, because my handwriting was really, really, really bad. When I was in third grade, I had a special education teacher who taught me how to type. And that was a tremendous game changer, because it slowed me down. It created an artificial braking mechanism. It was a gap between my hands and my brain that forced me to pause. And it was enough of an organization tool that from that point forward, things were less chaotic. And they were still just as bad as you would expect them to be from an untrained mind. But they slowly got better. And I didn't write my first novel until I was in high school, but I had the good sense to burn it. And I will never confess to what it was about. I will take that secret to my grave.
Okay. Voss, what do you love about writing?
I have to agree with Justin. I think if you're a writer, you're a writer because you can't help but be a writer. It just happens. And if you're not doing it because if you can stop, you should stop. And I can't. Yeah,
I'm the same as both you guys. I can't stop writing. Even if I tried to stop writing, I couldn't stop writing. I just love it, and I do it. I'll be somewhere with my wife, and she'll look at me, and then she'll say, "Oh, you're writing," because I'm staring off into space, thinking about characters or plot or settings or something. So,
okay, now here's a question for you guys. In all seriousness, under what conditions do you write the best? Because I got a reason for asking, but I'm just curious.
That was one of my questions I was going to ask later. I write the best in a quiet room, no music, and looking at the computer with my hands on the keyboard and just pounding out the story. How about you, Voss?
I need to have noise, you know, a movie, a TV show, music, something that can work in the background. It doesn't, not one want it loud, because it can't distract me, so it can't be anything I don't know. But I need that, but I also prefer being alone, but with noise. So it's kind of a paradox, but it works.
How about you, Justin?
Yeah. You guys are comparatively sane, I guess. The thing is, I work best in winter. There is something about the Alaskan winter that just does it for me. It's when it's perpetually dark, and it's just quiet as a tomb. It works for me. I can't tell you why, and it's probably something related to my lack of eyesight. But I do have the bad habit of working strange hours from six p.m. to 6 a.m. And there's just something about that just makes it go. And from like November to February, that's my peak productivity period, and I don't know if that makes me Jack Nicholson or what, but it just works for me. And then during the Alaskan summer, when it's mostly daylight, like so many Alaskans, I want to be outdoors and I want to be doing anything else. And it's a lot harder to do this. I'll still make my quota. I'm something of a fanatic about that. I do a daily quota, but the creativity is just not quite there. But in the dark, in the winter, when it's like 35 degrees below zero, then I'm like Evan. I'm in here with my hands on the keyboard, and it just hammers out.
Wow. Yeah, I have relatives in Alaska, and I visited there a few times. I was there in December a couple of years ago, and I remember the sun came up about 10 a.m., went down about 2. When it was up, it was gorgeous. It was beautiful. I was in Anchorage, and you could see the mountains around the city, and they were covered. It was beautiful, but the sun just wasn't. It was up for like 4 hours. And then I was there in the summer, and the sun went down at 3 and came up at 4. So, you know, it's an interesting environment. See, you guys you're taking all my questions. Justin, you say you have a writing quota, but do you plot out beforehand, or do you just write it as you go? Are you, you know, the terms are plotter or pantser? Which one are you?
Oh no, I am an inveterate schemer. I plot and scheme very far ahead of time. I work with loose outlines. And as a former bureaucrat, only mildly reformed, I live and die by lists. So my office looks like Russell Crowe just walked out of the room.
Okay, that's a reference
that
I don't get.
That's a beautiful mind.
Oh, beautiful mind. Okay. Yeah, I just saw that movie about 2 weeks ago for the first time. But you said Russell Crowe, and I started thinking Gladiator.
Well, I'm glad I could make such a timely reference for you.
Yes. Yes. Voss, are you a plotter, a pantser, or a plotting pantser, or?
Everything. I plot it to death. I plot most of my books two or three times before I actually have a plot I can work off of. My outlines normally end up minimum 5 pages per book, sometimes up to 20. So I like my plots. I like to know where I'm going and what I'm doing and how it all fits together.
Wow, okay. That's very, I'm sort of a pantser. In fact, I'm very much a pantser. I'll just sit down and start writing, and sometimes it works, and sometimes I really have to fix things in edits. I go, oh, in this chapter he was redheaded, and in this chapter he's blonde, you know, something like that. And so I'll have to fix that in edits and decide what color his hair actually is. We're going to take a break right now, and when we come back, I want to hear you guys read from your works. So stay tuned. We'll be back right after this.
You're listening to the Speculative Fiction Cantina on Rightstream Radio.
Monday afternoons at 1 o'clock Eastern on the Rightstream Radio Network. Tune in to Military Monday with host John D. Gresham, author, military historian, and journalist. John delves into a unique aspect of U.S. military history, as well as current events and issues affecting our men and women in uniform. Featuring exceptional guests, military experts, and authors, Military Monday with John D. Gresham entertains, informs, and encourages listeners to support those who put it all on the line for freedom. Military Monday with John D. Gresham. Monday afternoons at 1 o'clock Eastern on the Rightstream Radio Network.
This is the Speculative Fiction Cantina on Rightstream Radio.
And we are back. Voss, would you like to grace us with your reading?
I will. This is from The Jester Prince, which is the second King Jester book. Moonlight swirled down. Oh, go ahead.
No, it's just a go. I'm sorry.
Moonlight swirled down, mingling at the very edges of the fire. Peyote whipped a flask out of nothing and poured a messy drink into his mouth. Half of it went down the front of his jacket. Anyone? He offered it around, but no one moved. With a sigh, he put it back wherever it had come from. Honestly, you'd think I was trying to kill you. Madame Zerga scoffed. Not you directly. She showed him an image on her mirror. Red eyes. Blue's coming back soon. Coyote sat straighter. Lou. She nodded. Soon. I thought I should do you the courtesy of warning you. He nodded, slumping lower, but his shoulders never relaxed. Thank you. He scooted closer to Toby. We haven't been properly introduced, Tobias. Tragic. Coyote's fangs caught the firelight when he grinned. You have Madame Zerga's eyes. My mother. I know. He pulled even closer. You go by Toby, right? Yeah. Coyote's voice could barely be called a whisper. It quivered out, but the words could have been shouted for the way they splashed out at Toby. You must be the one he talks about. He's just trying to break you, even knowing that. His reply rushed out, frantic. Who? It couldn't be him. Couldn't. Coyote fixed his inhuman eyes on Toby. Marley. My brother. The fire didn't exist. It couldn't. Not if Toby could be this cold next to it. It had to be an illusion. He struggled to speak, his jaw just as frozen as everything around him. He only managed one word. Marley? Coyote nodded. But he's not doing very well right now. What? Not well at all. He came so close when he whispered that Toby could feel the moist heat of his breath. I can show you if you want. Yes, the word slipped out before Toby could even think about it. Are you sure? It's gruesome. And Toby wanted to hit him, pull his hair, somehow hurt him. But he couldn't risk it. The others hadn't heard their exchange. He needed them all to stay ignorant. Just do it, damn it. All right. Coyote traced a tiny circle in his palm. Toby knew as he watched that he'd jumped into the trap with both feet. But he had to. He had to see Marley. Even a month. Just as the circle started to fill with colors, Coyote pressed his palm against his leg, hiding the image from sight. Are you sure you want to see this? Toby gritted his teeth, a chance to do the right thing. Stop asking me that and show me. Coyote nodded, then turned his hand over. The image had cleared. Bile snaked up Tobias' throat, but he fought it down. For now. It had to be Marley. Eyes the right shade of blue, hair the right blonde, the same clothes he'd worn when King Jester had taken him. But the resemblance ended there. Dried blood covered his arms, now emaciated. His legs shook, just supporting his own weight. Manacles bound his arms to the stone wall behind him. He sported a full beard, scraggly and covered in filth. All the while his lips moved, muttering the same thing over and over. No sound, but Toby read his lips, had seen him say that word countless thousands of times. Toby, Toby, Toby. It played in his head, played in Marley's voice. Coyote closed his hand into a fist. When he opened it, the circle was gone. Nobody had noticed, otherwise they would have stopped him. Staring at the ground, Coyote shook his head. He's not even eating. We've tried to help him, but he just won't let us. Toby nodded, no longer hearing Coyote. He'd seen Marley near death, broken and battered, in a coma. That was nothing, not compared to this. He had to be in agony, a slow death. He didn't know how long a half-breed could survive like that, and he didn't want to find out. He almost missed Coyote rising. I really should be going now. I've done what I came here to do.
Is that it? Thank you. Justin.
Very well done.
Justin, tell us what we did something a little different with Justin. He sent us a pre-recorded reading, and so introduce it, and then I'll play it.
Certainly. What we have here is the opening paragraphs from short story number 7. This happens to be called, it's titled, There Are None So Blind. And somewhat autobiographical, although I didn't know it at the time. Everybody with a disability has the secret wish that they won't have that problem anymore. And when I wrote this, I was, to a certain extent, portraying my own secret wish. These words were originally written circa 2007. And the reason that they're somewhat prophetic to me is that they come true in 2012, but I couldn't know this at the time. And the gist of the story is that the central character is a person very much like myself who goes on to have medical science relieve him of his disability, and he goes on to have a grand adventure. This is the sort of thing that a lot of blind guys like myself would really like to have happened, but until medical science takes a quantum jump, it's still just fantasy for the moment. But that's the best introduction I can give you for this.
Okay, here we go.
Nothing is free. The things we want, no matter how small, come at a price. The bigger the desire, the higher the price. All I ever really wanted was to be a better person. I thought this meant knowing, understanding, and accepting my limitations. I was wrong. Being a better person means more than overcoming your limits. It means living up to your potential, even when you don't know what that potential is or where it will take you. I know this from experience. Let me start from the very beginning. The Sino-American Lunar War was in its third year when I showed up for that fateful doctor's appointment. Fighting in space was still new to everyone. Ships, weapons, and tactics were primitive by today's standards. I was off by myself in a corner of the waiting room, filling out the info blocks on the data pad. I was bored by the slow pace of WNN's live war coverage that was playing at low volume on the TV. My specific condition was aniridia. Loosely translated, it means that I was born with incomplete eyes. No irises. This, along with the early onset of glaucoma, meant that I would never see well enough to fly, drive, or be drafted. you don't miss what you never had, so it didn't faze me. My keen ears told me all I needed to know as I let the data pad scan the barcodes off my medicine bottles to let the doctor know what I was using to control my eye pressure. I accepted my blindness a long time ago. I've been that way since birth. The social prejudices associated with it were inconvenient, but tolerable. My condition was such that even the most modern cures and gadgets wouldn't work for me. When my regular doctor referred me to yet another high-tech specialist, I hesitated. Why get my hopes up again? When I finally got in to see her, the doctor got right to the point. She'd been reviewing my case history and genetic profile. I won't bore you with the details. Let's just say that my pessimism wasn't justified. Sounds funny to say it, but the idea of actually giving up my blindness was uncomfortable. It was my limiter, and I'd learned to live with it, or so I thought. I kept waiting for her to say, if this works, or which might improve, but she never did. Her presentation was entirely positive. Even so, it was still hard to accept. Gene grafting wasn't new, but you may recall that it had a mixed track record at the time. I'd rather not talk about the next 3 years. As traumas go, the agonies of early gene grafting were well worth the end results. I'm glad I did it. Medicine, in general, has come a long way since then. Just one word of caution. Medicine can take away some limiters, but it can't take them all. It won't prepare you for what comes next, either. When you can't see very well, it tames you in ways that are hard to describe. Small things, like looking for objects just out of arm's reach, become major expeditions to be undertaken with great care. Larger things, such as running, are unthinkable due to the risks. When the biopacks came off and the bandage gel was wiped away, my old limiters were gone. I lost my conservancy of action almost immediately. My wish for better eyesight had been granted. My journey to live up to my potential had begun. Before the surgery, my world was a gray haze. I couldn't count fingers beyond 2 meters. After 51 grafting sessions and twice as many post-operative follow-ups, I could see just as well as anyone else my age, maybe even a little better. I was 33 years old when I clearly saw the sunrise for the first time. It made me cry. It's fair to say that I wasn't ready for what was coming. Personal growth takes time and, sad to say, is comprised of about equal parts of success and failure. Forget what you saw in the movie. Nobody's life is perfect. Not even mine. Nothing looked like what I imagined. Everything was new, as if I were literally seeing it for the first time. People I had known for years were suddenly strangers with familiar voices. Many of my personal relationships changed so radically that, for a while, I was losing old friends faster than I was making new ones. This isn't unusual for somebody who has been released from a disability. Your trusted friends will accept your new status. The rest can go to hell. It was a true second chance at life. What did I do with my blank slate? I went nuts. When my longtime girlfriend left me because I wasn't the person she used to know, I stood in line at the Social Security office for 6 hours to get my disability status changed. Might as well live up to her expectations, I thought. I tossed or donated all my large print books, same with the audio books and the vocoder. I turned in my reading glasses for recycling. I had the digital magnification system taken off my bathroom mirror. I turned down the size of my TV screen to a respectable 77 centimeters. It had been nearly 200. I started applying for jobs. Then I went to the gym because I was F-A-T fat. I was on a treadmill, coughing up my lungs, when I saw it. I had the holograph set for empty highway. When the screen changed to an emergency news broadcast. Chinese assault troops had just taken the last American holdout on the moon. It's the truth. And that's what I say when somebody asks me where I was when our lunar bases fell to the Chinese. My father talked about Challenger, Columbia, and Atlantis. My grandfather talked about Kennedy. I didn't know it at the time, but the real defining moments of my life would take place out in space.
Thank you very much.
And there you have it.
Yes. I thought I was going to get drafted. Like,
now,
I
we don't
give
away the whole story.
Oh, okay. So, I like to have a little science story in these shows. And this one is from Discovery News. And I unfortunately lost the link to this, and my best Googling cannot find it again. But according to Discovery News, the most Earth-like exosolar world has been discovered. And it has a diameter just 10% larger than Earth. But it's the first planet that's been found to orbit its sun where water is liquid, if it exists. But its sun is smaller and redder than ours, and it's only 500 light years away, which means light takes 500 years to get there. And according to my calculations, and you might want to double check these because, you know, they are my calculations, if you took a ship and accelerated at 1G towards this sun, it would only, or the star, it would only take you 11 years and 2 months ship's time, thanks to relativity and time dilation. But for everyone else, it would take you over 500 years because it's 500 light years away. So, again, I lost the link. Normally I have the link on my blog. This time I don't have it. Maybe you can Google and find that. I tried. So do you have a, Voss, do you have a, we talked about where you're right. We talked about plotting. Do you have a ritual? You know, do you have to wear the same shirt, listen to the same music, have the same lighting? Is there something specific you have to do in order to write?
Sit down and put my fingers on the keyboard. That's about it.
Yeah. How about you, Justin? Do you have a writing ritual?
Too many to name, actually. It's just a matter of coming into the environment, the workspace, my office here. This whole small room has been tricked out for my benefit. It's, I guess some people would call it a man cave, but everything in here, the desk, the chair, the sound system, the whole thing exists purely for my convenience. I've got a small refrigerator, so I don't have to go anywhere for anything to drink. So it's all one great, big, huge crutch.
You know, it's amazing. I find I write better in my office rather than taking my laptop somewhere else and trying to write there. It's the setting. That's where you're used to being to writing. Voss, are you participating in NaNoWriMo?
Yes, I am. After much debate this year, I decided to do it again.
What do you see as the advantage of NaNoWriMo? And for those of you who may not know, NaNoWriMo is National Novel Writing Month, where you try to write 50,000 words toward a novel, or just a 50,000 word novel, in the month of November. Why are you doing it? What do you get out of it?
The most part, I just get a really fast book, so it's out and I can move on. I mean, I could technically write this way whenever I wanted to, but there's a structure in place with NaNoWriMo that isn't in with all the other months other than Camp NaNoWriMo, which is two other months and I never remember which ones. But it allows me to, you know, track my word count, and it opens you up to all the other writers who might be out there. So it's almost more of a social thing, but it does let me get the book out very quickly.
Yeah. It's 50,000 words in 30 days, so that's 1,667-ish words a day. And so, like, Justin, you got a quota for the whole month that you got to write. Justin, have you ever done NaNoWriMo?
I did it once, but in general terms, my quota is 1,500 a day. So
that's pretty close to the NaNoWriMo. Yeah.
And I work 6 days a week, so. in the winter months during my favorite period, November to February, I can pretty much double that. So I'm not doing too bad. So it gets the job done. But I do like the social side of these kind of things, as Voss was talking about.
Yeah, I do too. I'm doing NaNoWriMo this year also. Last year I did 8,000 words in one day. I think that's my record forever for words in a day. But that was towards the end of my novel, and I wanted to get it done. I had the climax all ready to go and everything. So, Voss, what do you suffer from writer's block? And if you do, what do you do to overcome it?
I don't necessarily suffer from writer's block. I don't necessarily believe in writer's block. But sometimes it can get a little slow. And when that happens, I just have to take a small break and focus on something that's not writing. And I can come back to it and get back to a regular amount of words.
Okay, how about you, Justin? Do you have problems with writer's block?
When it hits me, I will go for music. I will turn on the music, and there are plenty of times that I will actually play some appropriate mood music before I will start in on something. So, because I've got problems with the touchy-feely stuff, I'm not good with it. But when I know that I have to write the love scene, or I have to do something like that, then I'll look for something that's appropriately touchy-feely, or when it's time to write the firefight or the action adventure, then we'll dial up something that's good for that. So it's I'll use music to blast away the writer's block whenever I can. And on those rare occasions when that doesn't work, like the man said, go do something else for a while.
Yeah. Yeah, I tend to get my best ideas in the shower because I'm not thinking about writing. I'm thinking about showering. Yeah, when you were talking about music for the touchy-feely, I don't know if you remember the song. I think it was from the 70s called Feelings. It's a really sappy, cheesy song, and AT&T used it for a while in their ads. And I won't try to sing it because then everybody would turn off the radio if I tried to sing. So, Justin,
chalk
outside
that up
of writing,
your good deed for the day.
Yeah, that's my good deed for the day. I will not sing Feelings. Other than writing, what inspires you?
Well, I like to advocate for my favorite cause, which is people with vision impairments. There's a lot of folks out there that have this worse than I do. So it's nice to get out there and say a few things on their behalf. And when I'm not writing about alien psychology or the Kodiak starport, I do write on the subject of vision impairment. We'll actually have another book on that topic coming out next year, on top of everything else. So that's my favorite cause, and that's what inspires me.
Yeah, that sounds like a worthy cause. Voss, outside of writing, what inspires you? You say you cook, play trombone, sing, and belly dance.
Yeah, that's the major ones. I practice photography, and I've always loved music. And, you know, so I sing, I play trombone, and I haven't belly danced in a while, but I probably should start that again.
I've never seen a man belly dance, so I'm trying to picture this. Go ahead.
There's actually a lot of traditional belly dances that were done by men. So.
Oh, interesting. I did not know that. Learned something new. Do you have a favorite place to relax, Voss? When you need to get away, when you want to recharge?
Mainly, I either go visit friends, most of whom happen to be writers, oddly enough, or I'll go sit in a coffee shop.
It's funny how that works. Most of my friends are writers, too. Yeah, I have a Starbucks, I'm on a 12-step program for Starbucks addiction. And the first step is to admit you have a problem, and I've yet to do that one. So, Justin, do you have a favorite place to relax?
Actually, my very favorite form of relaxation relates to the wintertime. There's I like to go walking out near the highway late at night. There's a particular stretch of road that's several miles long, not too far from here, and when the moon is out, it will reflect off the mountains. I can't see that far, but I can make out just enough illumination to get the idea the mountains are there, and it's just so quiet. It's a very nice walk, and it's not quite the same in the summertime, but it's one of my favorite things to do in the wintertime, and it's just as far as actual relaxation goes, it's a real great stress reliever.
I bet. I hope you're wearing a reflective vest walking at night on a highway.
I am lit up like a 747 waiting for takeoff because I'm not totally stupid.
Good. I'm glad. I was worried about you. I have driven along the highway, and around here, in eastern Washington, there are some roads that have absolutely no lights on them, and people will be walking alongside the road wearing a black jacket and black pants, and you see them about 2 seconds before you almost hit them. Like, oh my gosh, there's a person in the road. Justin, we've talked about all sorts of writing and relaxation. Any other hobbies or interests?
I think you have pretty well summarized me in a nutshell.
In a nutshell.
I am my job.
Yeah. Well, we are all writers, and that's what we am. To put it badly. And Voss, where we talked about belly dancing and trombone and cooking and singing. So I
guess
those
are your...
Yeah,
but do you really want to do anything else?
No, I don't. Voss, do you want to do anything other than write?
Obviously I do, but I wouldn't give up writing for any of those things.
Right, exactly. All righty. So we're almost out of time. We're real close to the end of the program. Voss, do you have anything you want to add? Anything coming out? Anything you want to talk about? Or anything I failed to ask you that you are burning to say?
Well, like I said, I should have a serial starting late this year, early next year. Other than that, things are fairly up in the air right now.
A web serial, and that's going to be on your blog, vossfoster.blogspot?
I'll put the link there. It'll probably be on a separate blog.
Oh, okay. Yeah. I thought about doing a web serial, and then I just kind of cringe at the thought of having to do a web serial because I'm not disciplined enough to do that.
It really helps once you got it all written.
I'm sure. Justin, anything we haven't covered? Oh, we already talked about that. Yeah, anything we haven't covered you need to tell us about?
I think you've pretty well outlined everything quite nicely. I would just like to say that I hope your listeners will continue to support your show. This is a good concept you have here, and I hope you do quite well with it in the future.
Great. Thank you. I hope the listeners do support the show. I have seen the numbers, and they are not bad. They're not great, but they're not bad. Which makes me very happy. Well, I'd like to thank both my guests for their time, for spending the past hour or so with us, reading for us, talking to us about everything I could come up with. That's Justin Oldham and Voss Foster. Again, if you want more information on either of these gentlemen, go to my blog. That's blog.s7townsend.com, or you can get to it through my website, which is s7townsend.com, obviously. Or you can Google me, S7 Townsend, and my website should be the first thing that comes up on Google. And you can click that and then go to the blog. And right now there is a post that has links to their websites, links to their books, and a little bit more information about them. Again, thank you, gentlemen. I very much appreciate you taking time out to speak with me, and we'll be back next week with a very special episode of the Speculative Fiction Cantina. And normally I don't have this problem, but I can't. There it is. Couldn't find the file to hit.
This has been the Speculative Fiction Cantina on Right Stream Radio.